Okay, is everybody back?
Yep.
Okay. Art, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. So I first want to officially ask if there are any announcements. Well, just we can clarify, we were talking about some of the things. Most of us were at the NAAA meeting, so we don't have to do a review of that. But next week is going to be a climate literacy or climate education forum that's going to be in Washington, D.C., that Frank is going to. So maybe he can sort of give us an update on that after that's over. Are there any other activities going on?
Is that through the Board of Science Education, or is it that group putting that? Who's putting that on?
It's NCSE and ACE.
Oh.
And I think NEA.
Oh, and NEA?
NEA.
I think they withdrew. Didn't they withdraw?
What's that?
I thought NEA withdrew. There was a group that was originally helping with it. What?
It's at NEA.
Okay.
It was Climate Nexus that was the one that
withdrew. Oh, yeah, that's right.
But it's just really a beginning those strategic conversations on how to advance climate literacy and climate energy literacy, broader than just the the individual activities, but larger. And people like Secretary Salazar might be there, but I think it's raising the conversation and being more strategic and really trying to understand what that is.
Mm-hmm.
There's
I suggested to Mark that he might give one of the Climate Literacy Network talks on the outcomes of that. So maybe we'll schedule that in the not too distant future.
I think that would be a great idea.
Any other announcements? Go ahead, Art.
You're involved with this, Tamara. This thing after AGU. I just got an invitation from Mark, Climate and Energy Literacy. Summit in Berkeley?
Yeah, so that's a climate and energy literacy strategic summit. It's going to occur on Saturday and Sunday right after AGU, and I will be at that one. I won't be there next week, but I'll be at that one. So, and the purpose of that, I'm actually on the organizing committee of that, and the purpose there is to explore the possibilities of developing public-private partnerships. So that's going to be happening after AGU. And as you all probably know, we have quite a few sessions at AGU on climate literacy, and even more immediate, we have a number of sessions at GSA at the beginning of November on climate literacy.
I think that, the event in December after AGU is the one I was alluding to, that this is one of a series of conversations. And I think that that's probably going to be the case, that over the next couple months, we try and understand how that moves. This also connects to even though it's going to be October, the Tri-PI meeting is probably when that's going to be. At the last one we talked about engaging non-federal funders to broaden the engagement of how we get this work done without having to rely on NSF or NOAA or NASA funds alone. So I think these are just all in a series. If it's the same people having multiple conversations, and really seeing if we can move some of those ideas forward to larger scale deployment.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we will give an update on those conversations as they proceed. Okay. I think we'll move to our presentation for today. We have Art Sussman is going to be giving us a talk the Next Generation Climate Education Framework for the Pacific Islands Climate Education Partnership. And I think all of us know Art, but he is co-PI of that project, and we funded CSEP Phase 2 project. He's also Senior Project Director at WestEd and is a scientist who's worked for quite a while on enhancing K-12 education. And he's also the author of the Dr. Art books, the Dr. Art's Guide to Science and Dr. Art's Guide to Planet Earth. So With that, I will turn it over to Art. He has the slides he should have been able to download, and he might share them in other avenues also. So, Art, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. Thanks, Tamara. So if you're looking at the slides either in the PowerPoint or in the PDF version, I'm going to be talking my way through the slides. Does anybody not have them? Because I can show them on my screen through join.me and share that. Okay, so now just proceed with assuming that you're following along. So the first slide just is a picture of, not just, it's a picture of coral reef and has the name of our project. And we've been funded for phase two. And the next screen basically has the principal investigators, so Sharon Nelson-Barber at Prell. So Prell is a regional education lab. Comprehensive Center organizer in the region. They've been working educationally in the region for 20 years and have contacts with all the departments of education, myself at WestEd, and then we have University of Hawaii, Chip Fletcher, and we have the practitioners, which we have the ministries of education, but we also have an initiative with the community colleges, and Don Hess, who's a dean there, is leading that. And the next screen kind of shows a map of the region, which kind of gives the mistaken impression that there's a lot of land space there. But as you can see, these are all little dots in a huge, huge ocean. The geography of the region encompasses more time zones and greater geographical area than the continental U.S., but the places are small islands. The biggest being the Hawaiian Islands. The next screen is actually key to the talk, and that shows in our strategic plan we have four strands of work. So the one I'm going to be focusing on today is on the far left side, the climate education framework. So I'll be talking a lot more about that. And that's a way of helping everybody in our region know what is it that we're wanting teachers and students to know and be able to do, especially from a Western science perspective around climate and climate change and its impacts. And then we have a strand as well as on indigenous knowledges and practices, trying to especially relate what we know about what's known through centuries of people living in the on these islands. And those two together, the knowledges and practices inform the climate education framework, and those two together provide the framework for all the outreach activities. So under the outreach activities, we're under the learning and teaching strand, are things that we're going to be doing to build capacity of the teachers in the region, one of them being a climate certificating program at the community colleges, but then also things that everybody's familiar with in terms of kinds of professional development that we'd be doing to increase teacher content knowledge and actually focus on pedagogical content knowledge, not just knowing the content, but knowing how to teach the content in different contexts. And then we also have a significant strand of work where we're trying to make sure that the curricula that are available to students are actually true to the Pacific and match the students' realities. So they're learning about ecosystems by studying coral reefs or seagrass. Instead, a lot of the schools use outdated mainland textbooks, and they're exposed to pictures of ecosystems with sheep and fox and bears and who knows, moose, you know, just things that are totally inappropriate. And then another very significant strand is connecting community groups and schools around the education. And in part, there's just a large number of community groups that have expertise and resources and interests related to climate education, but that don't have the expertise with respect to working with schools or the connections with the schools. So we're providing those connections back and forth between schools and communities. There's a focus there on climate adaptation, because these folks are already dealing with and recognizing the impacts of climate change, particularly sea level rise and impacts on freshwater. So there's very little controversy in that regard. So we actually have a great opportunity to model how communities and schools can work together around adaptation. So the next screen that I'm showing, or looking at myself, I hope you're looking along, talks about this climate education framework. It was pretty clear that to work in all these different locations and with all the partners we have, that we needed guiding documents to help us all be on the same page with what it was that we were trying to imbue within the education system. I started work on this. We started work on this. I've been the lead on this part of the project around the time that the framework was being developed, and especially after the framework was released. We looked at it for the concepts. And actually, I pulled out all of the concepts and the core ideas that had a direct connection with climate, because it was talking directly about climate and climate change, or a foundational effect on climate education. For example, things like how heat moves with conduction, convection, and radiation is foundational for understanding a lot about weather and climate. So anything related to that, I pulled out as well. The other thing we did is contextualizing this for Pacific Island climates, impacts, cultures, and education realities. And just like the framework, we worked with the same four bands of K2, 3, 5, 6, 8, 9, 12. The plan is to update this climate education framework annually, especially bringing in more as we relate more things that we gather about traditional ecological knowledge, and then also updating it, for example, as the next generation science standards move forward. We're not expecting big changes in the core ideas, but maybe some ideas about how the practices and the core ideas and the cross-cutting themes are interlinked. And as I've said, this framework aims to guide the teaching and learning and the community school partnership strands. So what I'm going to do now in the rest of the presentation is walk you through a little bit with an overview of this climate education framework, so you get a sense of what it is and where we're trying to go with it, and also give you at the very end, there's a link so you can download it and examine it in depth, but just to walk you through the general idea of what it is. So now I'm looking at a screen that the title is Organization of PSEP CEF Climate Education Framework, and on the left side there's a list, a bulleted list, that's the organizing content. So it's very much an Earth systems approach. It's looking at Earth's matter, the biosphere, energy in the Earth system, just the concept of Earth system science itself, weather and climate change impacts on human societies, engineering climate mitigation and adaptation. And actually our focus is way more on adaptation than on mitigation, considering that the region doesn't contribute significantly to greenhouse effects globally, and that they're experiencing the impacts now and will be even more so in the future. And then we also will be including within the CEF the science and engineering practices. And currently we're using the next generation folks have some descriptions of how those play out as you go from K2, 3, 5, 6, 8, 9, 12. And we're using that as initial placeholders, and then getting feedback from the region about what's appropriate. And then also we are bringing in cross-cutting concepts. We're actually bringing those in more within the body of those bold statements, Earth system science. And a whole CEF has a very strong systems orientation. Okay, so now just to give you a sense, by working, you know, just kind of give an overview of what's in those seven bulleted sections. So we'll start with Earth's matter. And for the purposes of the this presentation, I'm focusing on what's in the grade 6-8s. As you might imagine, as you go through 9-12, it gets more conceptually complex, and then as you go to the 3-5, and it's getting more foundational as to what leads up to these understandings. So the guiding question about Earth's matter is what key science concepts about matter help us understand climate and its impacts in the Pacific Islands and globally. And there's three major headings: the molecular nature of matter, Earth's biogeochemical science cycles, and the properties of matter that directly relate to understanding climate. And I kind of included how many concept statements there were under each of those headings. So, for example, under the last heading, there's four concept statements. Two of them are about density, and one is about the properties of substances, and one is about acid-base balance. So these are things that you need to know about matter in order to really have some deeper understanding about climate. So the next screen actually shows the four statements that there are about the content related to these properties of matter that directly relate to understanding climate. And obviously, I'm not going to read each one, so maybe you could just look through. Or if we look at the last one, it's about pH. pH, acid-base balance, is a property of liquid solutions that is particularly important for life. Dissolving of CO2 in water causes the water to become more acidic, lower pH. So that's a core idea that's, you know, very important in terms of climate change and its impacts, especially when you consider the importance of coral reefs to these islands. And it's one thing that they all share in terms of ecosystems is fringing coral reefs and their susceptibility to problems because of ocean acidification. Okay, going to move on now to the second major heading. And these, of course, are not meant to be linear. You just have to have some order, which is the biosphere. And so similarly, what key science concepts about life help us understand climate and its impacts in the Pacific Islands and globally? The three major headings here are Earth's organisms, and there are seven concept statements related to that. Pacific Island ecosystems, there are four concept statements to that, and biodiversity, three concept statements. And I guess one of the things that I'd like to put out is I see what we're doing as being a potential model for other places, other regions, and obviously they would have something related to their local ecosystems as opposed to Pacific Island ecosystems. So I didn't choose to spell out any of the concepts in under the biosphere. The next heading that I'm focusing on is energy in the Earth system. And here we have two major headers. One is the nature of energy, where there's six concept statements, and the other is following the flows of energy into, within, and out of the Earth system, and there's four concept statements there. And I highlighted two of those concept statements because I think they're useful, interesting ones to look at. One of them is actually a way of describing and defining energy that I think is clearer than a lot of what I've seen around. And it comes from work at WestEd with a group called Making Sense of Science.
Hello?
Hello? Hello? Who is that? Did somebody have a question? Well, go ahead, Art.
Okay. Yeah, and please do feel free. I'm kind of working my way through and then assuming we'll have a discussion afterwards. But if there's something that jumps up sooner, I'd love to be interrupted. So we were looking at the energy statements, and I was saying that at WestEd we have a group called Making Sense of Science that does really nice work about uncovering the pedagogical content knowledge that teachers need to have to teach about key concepts like energy and matter. And so the work they've done on energy, they actually use this kind of definition that every system has a measurable property that is called its energy, and energy is a number that describes how much change can happen in a system. And then they build from that description to, you know, looking at energy transformation, conservation of energy, et cetera, et cetera. And then the other concept statement that I highlighted in the energy section is kind of a global one of looking at how energy is on planet Earth. The functioning of planet Earth relies on a constant input of energy from the sun. The absorbed solar energy circulates within the Earth system and eventually leaves it as heat radiating to outer space. From a systems point of view, Earth is an open system with respect to energy. So that's part of one of the reasons I highlighted it here was to show how we're embedding the cross-cutting concept of systems within the core ideas. So the next screen is actually a major model of that, just picking out Earth system science as its own header with concepts related to that. And under that, there's two main headers, two subheaders, systems and Earth system science. So systems being just general understandings of systems that will help us get an even better handle on what Earth system science is and how it helps us understand planet Earth and climate issues. And then there's six concept statements under Earth system science. Then there's a header specifically for weather and climate. What major science concepts help us understand weather and climate in the Pacific Islands and globally? And there's two subheaders, one, local weather and regional climate. So that's just about what the climate conditions are themselves. And then regional and global climate change, where there's six concept statements relating to that. Then another header is climate change impacts on human societies. And the guiding question is, how will climate change impact human societies in the Pacific Islands? And there's just one subheader under that at the 6A level, regional perspectives on climate change impacts. And I highlighted, there's seven concept statements, and I highlighted one of them. One thing I haven't pointed out is each concept statement has kind of a letter numbering system, so you can see how they're related within a grade level and then across grade levels. And this one's highlighting freshwater issues in the Pacific, and it's an example of how teaching about the water cycle in the Pacific is different than teaching about it in other places. The underground sources of freshwater on Pacific islands float on top of seawater. These freshwater lenses can be shrunken and contaminated by salt as sea level rises or the ocean surges over the land. So most of the locations, the rock is permeable, so water just goes right through it, and the underground water isn't in an aquifer. It's a lens of freshwater floating on seawater. And then the next major subheading is engineering climate adaptation and mitigation, 6-8. And we love that the next generation science standards have an engineering focus. It's much more practical oriented, we hope, for the students and teachers, and also gives us a great entree for what the communities are actually engaged in with climate adaptation. So as you can see at 6-8, we don't talk about mitigation at all. It's all about climate adaptation. There's two concept statements about what climate adaptation is, and then six concept statements relating to engineering climate adaptations. And I picked out one that shows the integration of another cross-cutting concept models. So the statement I highlighted is, there are many types of models ranging from simple physical models to computer models that can be used to investigate how a design might work, communicate the design to others, and compare different designs. And one thing here I'm highlighting also is this is actually a verbatim quote from a core idea in the grade 5 framework and the grade band. And one thing we have to be pretty aware of in the Pacific is most of the communities, the teachers and the students are English language learners. English is a second language, and we have to think carefully about what we teach where. Especially in the case here, we're talking about models which might is not familiar with them. So starting at a lower, simpler level of understanding in 6-8 than maybe what the framework calls for. The last screen is about exploring further. So there's a link to our major website that's our information platform. That's the website with the pcep.dsb.wested.org link, and that's a great place you can find out more about the islands and more about the climates and also background about climate science and climate impacts. We interlink all of that information, and it's the way that we try to have everybody who's working be on the same page. And then the second link there is specifically to the K-12 climate education framework. And I'm happy to discuss and collaborate with others about organizing K-12 climate education, the issues in PD, the possibility of connecting communities and schools around climate adaptation. And I have my phone number and email address. So that's it for
okay.
me just talking.
Okay, well, thanks, Art. Are there any questions?
Art, this is Kristen Poppleton. We just met last week.
Yeah, hi, Kristen.
How are you? this is really interesting as someone that does a lot of curriculum development. I'm just poking around the page right now, but I'm wondering, am I going to find that framework also on there just to be able to look at the way you organized it? It just sounds really, really, really well done.
Thank you. Yeah, if you looked at that Exploring Further screen, the last screen, if you click on that second link, it'll take you directly to the K-12 framework, and you can actually download it from there, and you can just view it from there. There should be a link when you go there where it says View Resource, and if you click on the View Resource, it may take a little while to open up, but then you can actually just see it and scroll through it there.
Great.
Art, one caveat is download. The view is flash-based, but in the upper right corner, there's you can see it another way. So just in case somebody's using an iPad or something like that, like I am.
Okay.
So up at the top right, there's a download this attached file after you click the view resource. So that's cool.
Thank
you.
Okay, I should look at it.
Could I ask how you developed these? Was it input from the communities on the various islands in the partnership, or how were these developed?
The first round of it was mostly me and consulting with. As a climate change partnership, we have. Climate scientists and learning science and practitioner teams, so the three teams. So I took the first shot of going through the framework, the conceptual framework when that came out, pulling out all the concepts and then kind of organizing them in this way. In part, that organizational scheme grew out of work when we were doing our, we call it ReefNet, that database, pcep.dsb.wested.org. It's nowhere on the website is called ReefNet, but this is our own name for it. So anyhow, this ReefNet information platform has a way of organizing resources that help people understand about climate and its impacts. And so there's a climate science section of that, which is organized in this very parallel Earth systems way. So that took us quite a while to develop, and that was collaboratively developed. But having that, and it's also based on, the way I've been teaching about Earth systems, for a long time now, that provided an organizational framework. So that led to the seven headers, Earth's matter, the biosphere, energy in the Earth system, Earth system science, etc. And so I organized everything that I pulled out of the framework under those seven. Then I circulated those statements, and I also took a first shot at contextualizing them for the Pacific with respect to, you know, our climate issues and our climate impact issues, and also some idea about where kids are at and where the system is at, what it could actually handle educationally. And then that got circulated. The first major round of revisions was with our climate science team. So we had input from from the East-West Center, which is also based in Honolulu, Paxis, John Mara, you know him. Some of you know him. And yep. And then also we have a climate scientist that's partnered with us from the University of Washington, who actually does his research in the Pacific Islands. So I got a lot of feedback from those guys. And then once we were, I was feeling definitely very comfortable about the science accuracy, then we circulated it with some of the educators in the region from our practitioner team and got feedback from them. So it was definitely collaborative. I'd have to say that the initial shot at it was much more me doing it, and I think honestly that it benefits from having a one-person first shot rather than a committee approach, and then getting the committee involved in the making it, you know, the refining part.
Mm-hmm. Great. Art, this is Karen Holwig. I'm finally on the page. Can you repeat what you told Kristen about where to go to find...
Oh, with the Exploring Further page?
And how do you see that?
So so on the preview or the PDF version of what I put up, the last page...
I'm at the homepage that says Pacific Islands Climate Education Partnership.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so... there was another link at the so to get there from that page. I'm not on there right now. I'd have to go there for a second.
You can click on the resources, Karen.
Yeah, click on resources.
And then if you scroll down, there'll be a list of a bunch of them.
Yeah, and I put the climate education framework as a K-12 document, but you can also access it as K-2, 3, 5, 6, 8, and 9, 12, four separate documents.
Thanks.
Another way to do it is you could just do a search for a climate education framework in the search bar box.
Okay.
And I can email you separately. If you looked at that the last page of what I uploaded as the presentation, it has the direct link to the K-12 framework.
Yep, I've got it. Thanks.
Okay, cool.
So... maybe I missed you mentioning it. So the framework being developed now, is the next phase then focusing on creating some actual teaching resources, or has that already been done? Or
So it's guiding any of the work that we're doing around. We have done a little bit, but that's a lot of what our year one of our implementation.
Uh-huh.
So we've been funded for the hopefully full 5 years of implementation. And so we have professional development that's going on, and we're doing some curriculum development, but mostly what we're doing is taking stuff that's out there that we like and contextualizing it better for the Pacific, and so it aligns better with this climate education framework.
And are you finding a lot of? I'm really interested in you guys doing stuff with adaptation, because that's where we have. It seems like there's not much out there, for repurposing for adaptation.
Right. So we got lucky. kind of like parallel, just about when we were getting started early in our phase one, we discovered that there was a group in Micronesia that had produced a series of materials called Adapting to a Changing Climate, and it was developed by the Micronesia Conservation Trust. And it's materials that they're using for working in communities to help them with their thinking about climate adaptation, planning it, and actually implementing it. So we've partnered with the Micronesia Conservation Trust. A way to find that document is, again, if you go to our ReefNet website and just search for Adapting to a Changing Climate, you'll find it. It'll take
great.
You right there. You can download it. And what was great for us is it did something that we couldn't do. It has the look and the feel and the reality of the Pacific Islands. And it's pretty good. It's pretty good. I mean, there's nothing grossly wrong with the climate science in it. There's some things, you know, like I would always do a little differently, like explaining El Nino, La Nina. But otherwise, it's a great resource. So actually, the one major curriculum development piece that we're doing is to, based on that, those materials, to actually come up with project-based learning models of curricula for teachers and students and communities. So that's work we're engaging in year one. And even for that, we're drawing pretty heavily on stuff that's out there. So another way of addressing the question you raised is what jumped out at me about climate adaptation is basically you're doing two things in climate adaptation. One relates to the ecosystems and biodiversity, and what you're doing is anything you could possibly do to make the ecosystem healthy so that it's more resistant, more resilient to the changes of temperature and precipitation and acidification. So when you think about that, it means that you can draw upon a lot of curricular resources that are out there about teaching about ecosystems and the effects on ecosystems and what keep ecosystems healthy. So that's actually adaptation-related education. The other one, which is going to require more new development, is the other aspect of adaptation, is doing everything you can possibly do to help make the local infrastructures be as sustainable and as robust as possible and as flexible as possible. And so I agree, there isn't a lot of stuff out there about that at all. And we actually
that brings in the engineering piece.
It brings in the engineering piece, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
I think our first big effort along that line is going to be related to freshwater security, because we have a great hydrologist who is based in the region who's done some wonderful stuff around that. So we're going to be looking at building curricula. Or he's actually subcontracted to help us develop curricula around freshwater security.
Cool.
Yeah.
Fun project.
So Art, one key piece, and I would imagine John Mara or other people associated with the National Climate Assessment would be kind of giving you the information you need as it comes out on the science side.
Right.
More on the assessment side, not the individual, you know, papers or anything like that, but you know, over the 5 years you guys are going to be funded, there's going to be updates between the next National Climate Assessment and the next IPCC assessments, because you alluded to one resource where the climate science wasn't all that great, or I can't remember exactly how you put it, but the change.
It was this adapting to a changing climate, which is a great resource about what communities can do to adapt, and explaining
right.
when they explained to communities about climate change, they had a figure about just explaining El Nino. Which I would, you know, I'm kind of a purist about how you teach science concepts, and so I would tweak what they did. It wasn't that it was wrong; it's just I would tweak it.
I got
is
you.
All I meant. But relating to what you said, Frank, we have a great resource in the East-West Center in that they actually had the responsibility for writing the assessment for the region. For the next iteration of global climate change in the U.S. And they're actually having workshops in December to help bring all of us that are involved on board about what's in the materials that they forwarded about the climate change and impacts for the next overall assessment. So it's a great resource that we have to tap into.
I'm very happy to hear that, Art. I mean, you know, because that's a really you're the first of the CSEPs that have talked about it in that context. I would imagine Made Clear is probably doing some of that, but I haven't heard it said like you just did. And that makes me very happy.
Yeah, no, he's having a three-day meeting December 10th through 12th in Honolulu, bringing people from the region and a lot that have been working on getting all the data for that. And his project has an education and outreach component, and basically we and University of Hawaii working with us are that education and outreach component of their work.
Fantastic. So there's one other person that you should know about, Art, who was with NOAA Climate, who's now going back to the region as the NOAA Regional Coordinator, and that's Eileen Shea.
Yeah, I know Eileen.
So if you know her, she's back in your camp. She should be out in Hawaii very soon, if not already.
Okay. Well, I imagine she'll be at that meeting.
I would imagine so. So
okay.
Just make sure you connect with her. She's spectacular.
Yeah, I know. Great.
Okay,
thanks.
There you go.
Martha, I was wondering if you were, I was just with the Pacific Voyagers and the Polynesian Voyagers at the Blue Ocean Film Festival and the NOAA Thompson. I wondered if you had been hooking up with them in Honolulu.
Yeah, actually, so our UHPI is very involved with them. And so
okay.
They actually have a subcontract through our proposal. And so we're trying to, since we have a culture and indigenous knowledge piece, their work fits in very well with that. And we think that they also, quite frankly, have a marketing potential for us. Like when they go someplace, people get excited and teachers and schools want to be involved. So they're actually going to be having a worldwide voyage that's just got launched. I think they're starting in New Zealand or Tahiti, and they're going back towards Hawaii. And then they're going to go to American Samoa this coming summer, which is actually perfect for us because we've hooked up with a group called Project Ocean Science that developed curricula around corals and climate change, and they're going to do a five-day workshop in American Samoa. And so we're going to try and hook in with the traveling ships, boats arriving there, and just fill that up as much as we can.
Well, that's a job from Earth Advertising, and I'm on their communications team, so I'll try to send you a separate email.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Art, can you step, if this project is obviously multifaceted and has a bazillion partners, can
right.
you step back a little bit and give us an overview of the project as a whole and where you're going and what you're trying to achieve?
Sure. So the project as a whole, I think more than the other, but except with that, perhaps the Maryland, Delaware one, has a K-12 focus. Clearly, we want to work with communities because we have a strand on community school partnerships. Basically, we are working in a region which is very diverse in a bunch of ways. And on one end of the spectrum, we have Hawaii, which, you know, is a lot like, in educationally, the more close to the U.S. Then there's three nations that are actually pretty, they're called territories. So they're actually closest to being more like Hawaii, and the closest one of those is Guam. And then the next one near Guam, there's a country called the Commonwealth of the North Mariana Islands, and then there's American Samoa. And those three have a closer relationship with the U.S. And Guam and the Mariana Islands are more similar to Hawaii, but they're starting to be poorer and more culturally different and having people not have English as a second language. And then the third of those that I mentioned, which is the American Samoa, is actually furthest away from being like Hawaii of that group. And you start having much higher levels of poverty, much higher levels of English as a second language. So that's four of the, quote, entities of our region, Hawaii, and then the three territories. And then there are three called Freely Associated States. So these are actually countries that have representation in the United Nations, but they still have a very special status with the U.S. People can come to the U.S. Without getting visas, and they can work in the U.S. without getting work permits, etc. And those are the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Republic of Palau, and the Republic of Marshall Islands. And then when you, so there, now you're talking to where much even more poorer and much more language proficiency, English as a second language issues, and cultural differences. And then with the Marshall Islands, you have the fact that the whole place is an atoll. There's no place at all with height. And the projection is that they're going to be uninhabitable within 50 years. So here we have this vast region with this spectrum of culture and poverty and language proficiency, and this spectrum of the climate impacts that they're already experiencing from increasing sea level and its impacts on their freshwater security, their home security, their food security, public health, etc. And you have this region where climate change is not a controversial issue. It's happening, it's recognized, and people are concerned about it, very concerned about it to varying degrees. And so our project aims to try to build from what there is and increase the capacity for doing scientifically valid, culturally appropriate climate education throughout the region. Because that's what NSF wanted. They didn't want a project where you're working in one school district. They wanted something that was broad in scope for the climate change partnerships, and that's what my colleagues who live and work there want, is something that's going to start addressing this broadly and be able to be sustained over a long period of time. So we spent the first 2 years, it was great that we had 2 full years of funding to build the partnership, find out about everybody there, deepen our own knowledge about climate in the Pacific Islands and its impacts, get the right partners, bring UH on board. UH was not one of our original partners because they had their own proposal that was not funded, so bringing them on board and integrating them within the project. Basically, the thrust is to do everything that we can to build capacity within the region and provide resources that are going to, over time, lead to better and better and better climate education that's going to be more and more meaningful to the communities. And that's where we heard pretty clearly that understanding the Western science, yeah, that they want to do that, but knowing what they should do about it and the changes and what those changes are going to be are much more compelling motivators. So does that answer your question?
Yes. Can you say just one more short paragraph about how you work with all these people? I mean,
Prell, who's the awardee, Pacific Resources for Education and Learning, has been working in the Pacific region for 20 years. So if you're familiar with regional education labs or groups that work regionally, Prell is one of them. And so they have the contacts with the ministries of education, the curriculum instruction chiefs. So they have an advisory board of that's the curriculum instruction chiefs from each of these locations. And we've worked with that advisory board to help bring them on board. So we are benefiting from their and also UH's contacts throughout the region. And as you know, whenever you work in a high poverty area, disadvantaged area, you're going to run into even more dysfunctionality within the systems than you might run into in some other places. But my colleagues also point out all the time that we also have strengths that we build on. So there are strong cultural traditions that help provide cohesion, that the people live there are closely connected with nature. I mean, you can't live on a small island and not be connected with nature. So there's cultural strengths, there's indigenous knowledge, there's traditional practices that all are things that we can build on. So it isn't just that the region has challenges, the region also provides opportunities and strengths.
Thanks.
Art, this is Frank. A quick question for you. See, we're almost out of time. One of the things that, you know, at the last week's NAAA meeting, and Karen, you've done this for our community often, with along with others from the environmental education community, is more the skill development and behavior, you know, change, or however you want to characterize it. But you know, the science education side doesn't really focus on that piece as much as more the environmental education side. And clearly, you're alluding to it here, but do you see that broadening of the normal set of what we do in science education in the context of this work?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, I'm not sure how many constraints I have in doing what we might otherwise do. So in the some ways, yes. I mean, we are, I think one of the reasons we got the continuing funding is because we are working to be culturally appropriate and also to draw upon the indigenous knowledges and practices. So there's that. I think NSF is walking a tight line about making, you know, this is being funded as a science education from the National Science Foundation. So we do have to have, you know, a fairly strong emphasis on understanding what we know and understand, you know, from a Western science perspective. And we have to be careful, even though people in the region acknowledge climate change and are already beginning to engage in these adaptation practices, we have to be careful about not advocating specific practices. You know, to do good environmental education, what we need to be doing is helping people have the background knowledge and skills that they need so that they then make the decisions and then do the implementations in effective ways. So they're making the right decisions. Well, I would hope, I mean, what they will consider to be the right, and I hope it matches what we think are the kinds of decisions that follow from understanding the climate change and its impacts. So I don't know if that was a political answer.
But Art, it's not really a political answer in the sense that you know, the line is clear that we're not the experts at this. These are
right.
We're building capacity. You know, I saw one talk about the building of human capacity so that the people can move forward and make the decisions.
Right.
And I think that you know, it's really why I'm interested in this is exploring the appropriate space where education and climate change, you know, exist. We all have to be careful of that for lots of reasons. I think that you're going to be exploring it very intimately. And I think that the more lessons you learn and where that line is and why it's there, the better off all of us.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things we feel is that we actually have an opportunity to be kind of pioneers in this climate adaptation work. We don't have to do the convincing that climate adaptation needs to happen, so we can actually engage in it, and we won't be proselytizing. But we'll be learning how to work with communities around that, and that's why it's great that we have the partners in the region who come from these locations and are working there.
Well, just one other point that I would emphasize, Art. I think one of the things that we in the education community, especially when you're dealing with this side of the equation, always struggle with, at least in the science agencies that a lot of us feel, is that the science comes first, and
right.
What you're doing is you're exploring why education is important in the context of this climate issue.
Right.
You know, science alone isn't sufficient, and education alone isn't sufficient, but they're really partners in this endeavor.
Right.
I mean, Art, I think you said that pretty well. You were talking about how this is exploring the science, but also the pedagogy piece.
Right.
And I don't think that means that the science doesn't come first. It just means you have to think about the way that you are providing the science or framing the science to bring in a a word from rhetoric, but, you know, so it doesn't necessarily mean that the science isn't coming first. It's just the how part.
Right, right. There was actually one of our staff people just circulated a link to a video called something like Looking for a Mountain, or something like that. And it's about these, the guy who is involved, his name is Goodall. I don't know if he's any relation to Jane Goodall, but anyhow, he ended up on this atoll. I'm not sure exactly where it was, and he connected with the people there, and they'd all been experiencing, changes, but they didn't. They are so divorced, so outside of the mainstream, they didn't know about climate change at all. They never heard the term, and they never heard about sea level rise. And so he was there, and he explained to this, this one local chief about it, and the guy went. He went immediately running across, to the neighboring area to get the other local chief and assemble all the people, because they didn't know that this was a phenomenon. They were observing it, but they didn't know this was a global phenomenon, that the sea levels were rising and they were going to keep rising.
Interrupt a second. I'm going to have to just interrupt. I need to leave. You're welcome to continue the conversation, but I just wanted to let you know that I had to step away. So go ahead and carry on.
Well, I'm available to hang out for however long. One of the things that I'm curious about is what we can do to have more networking around the kind of work that's shown with the climate education framework. Because when I shared it with Jill Karsten, one of her concerns was, well, we don't want 100 different people all over, working on their own, doing this kind of thing. That would be too much duplication of effort. So whether there's any way that those of us who are doing this work for whatever reason, looking at the concepts and the skills and the practices and organizing those for our, particular context, the ways that we can collaborate together.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at it right now, and I see it being something really useful. It's very nicely organized, and makes a lot of sense to me. It's not as organized as we were when we wrote our last curriculum, which was, more similar to you in that it was focused on Minnesota, on a particular area. But obviously, yours is goes much more into depth, and it would be very useful to us as I'm going to look at it now as we're jumping into our next project here.
Cool.
For sure. And if you want me, I'm probably will follow up with a call to you about that as well. But
okay.
I also, are you familiar with the Gillian Roerig's Cycles project here in Minnesota? You guys should be in touch because she's focusing on native ways of knowing around climate change.
I think
hers is a NAFTA. It was a NAFTA.
Yeah, I know her. We talked some at the tri-agency meeting, but we haven't followed up.
Okay. Well, I'll be working with her a little bit this year as well, so I'll be sure to.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
I think it's a very useful framework and could be very easily duplicated. Makes a lot of sense, and those are sort of the key. I see you even have the EE guidelines as well, so it's
right.
You guys have done a ton of work in here. I'm very impressed.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
And Art, I mean, I think that the Jill's point is I think all of us feel that way, and I think that the offer that you've given to the community about developing a common framework built off of the climate literacy principles were just principles. You've fleshed that out further, especially with the pedagogical piece, which is, as we all know, the doing of the next generation science standards is going to be huge. I think the pedagogical aspects are going to be absolutely needed. And you've given us a great starting point. So I mean, how we move that forward here is and build that community of practice. Given that Mayclear is one of the strongest connections, are you going to be you know, exploring that with them while they...
I hope to, yeah. We actually made this another connect with Made Clear in that this Teach Ocean Science project that has a pretty nice module around coral reef and climate change came out of that same part of University of Maryland that Don Bosch is in. So we have connections to follow up, but it's definitely something I want to explore with Don when he's at AGU, if not sooner.
Fantastic. So if I can help, I'm on the advisory board for Made Clear, and you know.
Oh, good. Yeah, help.
So if I can help with that, I'd love to.
Yeah.
Because ultimately we have to customize these approaches as you put forth.
Right.
Here, and they're going to be customizing for, you know, the Maryland, Delaware area.
Right.
And I think, you know, but still the common framework is going to be the interesting piece of how do these things gain value.
Right. Yeah, that would be great. I don't know who does that kind of work with Made Clear. I mean, I know it's a partnership and they've got different people doing different things, but I don't know their partnership well enough to know, you know, is that Don or is it somebody else?
No, it's not Don. It's the person
so.
You want to get. Marcus Griswold and Kat Selinsky, those
uh-huh.
are the two people that you want to talk to. But, you know, we can type that offline. But,
right. Great.
So I'm not sure how we end this.
We end it by saying it's over. What Tamara said was when everybody hangs up, then the system turns off and the recording stops. So why don't we stop it at this point? Okay, thanks, guys. It was very helpful to be able to share and to hear your comments.
Thanks.
Thanks, all.
Thanks, Art.
Bye.